Hey everybody, welcome back to the Brad Dukes Show. I'm your host, Brad Dukes, and today we've got a blockbuster episode with special guest Robert Forster. Robert Forster is an Academy Award-nominated actor who has been in a very long list of incredible works in film and television ever since the mid-1960s, and I can't wait to share this conversation with you. We talk about a lot of cool projects, including Breaking Bad, Mulholland Drive, Jackie Brown, so much cool stuff. Next year in 2017, Robert Forster is going to be in the upcoming installment of Twin Peaks. I've seen things, I've heard things, but I can't say things, but I think it's going to be very interesting. And he's going to share a story with us about how he almost was in the original Twin Peaks back in the early 90s. Before we get to that conversation, please head over to iTunes or SoundCloud. Make sure you're subscribed to The Brad Dukes Show. Leave me some comments. Leave a 5-star rating, because those 5-star ratings help me get special guests just like today. I appreciate your support as always. All right, let's cut to the chase with the main event, Robert Forster.
Brad Duke.
Robert Forster, how are you?
Good, I was just about to call you. How is my reception?
You sound pretty good.
Okay, so I'm in my car because I thought it was a little bit loud in the restaurant. And if you consider this adequate, we will proceed.
Okay, yeah, it sounds great. Growing up, what inspired you to want to be an actor?
Oh, I didn't want to be an actor until my senior year at the University of Rochester. I was pulling into a parking lot, and as I stopped in a slot in front of my car, walked a beautiful brunette. She was wearing a black London Fog raincoat and high heels. I was struck by lightning. I leaped out of the car. I followed the girl. I was trying to think of something to say. She walked into the auditorium. They were doing an audition for Bye Bye Birdie. I'd never seen the play, and I had never seen the movie, but I had seen the trailer to the movie, and I knew it was about a guy with a gold suit who does a parody of Elvis Presley. And I said, well, that's how I'm going to meet the girl. I'll audition for that. I auditioned for the part of the guy with the gold suit, but they didn't give it to me. They put me in the chorus. The chorus, I thought, the heck with that. I don't want to be in the chorus. And then I thought, well, how about the girl, Bob? If you stick, you'll meet the girl. I did meet the girl. Later, I married the girl. We have 3 daughters. So that was my very first moment, except for the 4th grade when I sang In Your Easter Bonnet with a girl named Mary. But that was it. And I didn't think any more about it until the very end of the year, when a guy came up to me at the University of Rochester my senior year and said, I'm directing a one-act Irish comedy. Would you like to play the hero? Now you're talking, I thought to myself. Sure. And by the time I finished doing that, I said to myself, I don't want to be a lawyer. I want to be an actor. I wonder how you do it. I went to my father. My father, who had spent the 1930s on the Ringling Circus. He started out as a roustabout and then joined the bull department, the elephant department. So he trained and worked with elephants for a number of years during the 1930s before World War II. Mm-hmm. He, when I told him I wanted to be an actor, did not miss a beat. He said, I think you could do that, Bob. And so I went to New York City, not having a clue that there were a zillion actors and a very, very small amount of parts. It was one of those big discoveries that, sure, you can do it, Bob. Almost anybody can do it. Kids can do it. How hard could it be? So that was the big surprise. I got to New York City, hadn't a clue, had not a plan, dodged around New York from a rented room. Went back to Rochester, New York, as a substitute teacher. I had a degree by then. And little by little, for about a year, I met a girl who said, would you like to do a scene with me for my class? And I said, sure. We did the scene for her class. Then we did that same scene for an agent. The agent came to me and he said, I'd like to send you on an interview. I went to the interview. I got a reading for a play. I had an audition for that play. It was a two-character play on Broadway in 1965. Mrs. Dalley has a lover. I get the play. From there, it is a series of steps. I did a what they used to call a screen test for 20th Century Fox in 1965. They hired me. They put me under contract. I was one of the last contract players in Hollywood, 1965. And I got married to that girl, June. We drove out to Los Angeles. As soon as I got here, there was a phone call from the agent. The agent says, "Do you know who John Huston is?" I said, "No, I don't." He says, "Well, he's a big guy in this business, and he wants to meet you for Reflections in a Golden Eye." I read it quick. I flew to New York City. I had a meeting with him. I got the movie, so now I'm in the movies. It is what you call the kind of luck that only happens in fiction. Being in the right spot and being the character they were looking for at the time, and also never forget that it's not like being a musician. If you tell people you play the trombone, they say, "Take your axe out. Let's see what you got." Or if you tell them you're a magician, they say, "Let's see a trick." If you tell them you're an actor, nobody says, "No, you're not." It's the thing that you got to fake right from the very beginning. It is fakery. It is a fakery with belief. And it is something you can get better and better at if you try. And so over time, I've gotten slightly better. And there you go. You got a career, and it's already 52 years.
Yeah. Was it intimidating to, in your first film, be sharing the screen with Marlon Brando and Elizabeth Taylor?
It didn't seem to be. I remember thinking, God, these people must be worried about me because I have no experience. I wasn't worried about them. They surely knew what they were doing. But the only ones that I thought needed to worry were them because, I was unknown and had no clue. I was doing it by, I can't quite tell you, but I certainly started out with some ideas. The ideas were, how do you be real and how do you make your audience believe you and how do you keep it going and how do you find a joke and hit the joke? You know, there's lots and lots and lots of things that you discover over the years, but before I went to New York City, I had done a play at the Rochester Community Theater during the time between I decided to be an actor and the moment I actually left. It was several months before I actually left for New York City, in which I did a play, Come Blow Your Horn, which is a Neil Simon play. And I remember, and I did it for the community theater, and I got a great laugh. What a seductive thing getting a laugh is. And there you go. Well, one thing after another really draws you in. And the next thing you know, you're saying there's stagecraft involved in this. And how do you present for a stage? So little by little by little, you gather. And over time, you say, and it took me years and years before I would even say out loud that I was an actor. I worried I'd be found out and kicked out before I got it right. So there you go. You don't know until a long time later that you are actually an actor.
Yeah. So I'm curious, were you actually riding that horse naked, or did you have like a body double in that movie?
Oh, what a thing that was. I remember... they sent me the script after I got this job with John Huston. They sent me the script, and I read the script, and in the script it said, this guy rides the horse naked. And I said to myself, I wonder how they do that. Probably trick photography or something. No. When I got to Rome, which is where we shot this thing, one morning, we had already shot a few things, but one morning they drove me out to this forest. And in the movie, you can see it's beautiful. Forest, geometrically planted forest. And I, as we were approaching the set, I saw a guy riding around on a horse. He was naked. The camera was setting the shot, And they were following this guy around in a oblong loop. And I said, God, that's supposed to be me. I'm not going to let that guy do that shot. Cause you know, by then I had pride in my position. I said to myself, that's gotta be me. And I went to Houston and I said, you know, I could do that. And he says, can you really, Bobby? I said, sure, I can do that. You know, they put me on a horse, back in Long Island before we went to Rome. And I had a few, you know, a couple hours on a horse. And I said, yes, I can do this. And so the next thing I know, the wardrobe department handed me the little web V from a jock strap. Everything else was cut off, and a roll of flesh colored tape. And that was supposed to be for my modesty. And I tried hard to get this thing to stick on. But after I got on the horse and rode around a couple of times, it was cold. The horse was warm. The horse got a little bit lathery. And by the time I ran around, rode around on that horse for a couple of turns, this little web V got I pulled it off and tossed it in the bushes. And so I can only tell you that it was a moment of, yes or no. I said to myself, if you're scared of this, Bob, the idea of being naked out there was appalling to me. But I said, if you're scared of it, you will never be an actor. So you either gotta quit worrying about it and just go at it with abandon, or quit. That was the exact moment of decision. Either do it with abandon or quit. And I just kept going. I said, nah, I'm not afraid of this.
That's awesome. Well, I want to fast forward into the future and talk about Jackie Brown. I was a huge Pulp Fiction fan, and I was waiting for that movie. It felt like an eternity. Tell me about that experience and, you know, just what it's like to work with Quentin Tarantino.
Tarantino is really, as you see him on television, is what a good guy. What a wealth of knowledge. This guy knows everybody and everything. As you know, he spent time in a video store and watching movies. And I had auditioned for Reservoir Dogs some years before. I can't remember how long before, but it was, as you know, you said it was endless waiting for Jackie Brown. Mm-hmm. Because first there was Reservoir Dogs, and then there was Pulp Fiction, and a long gap, and then Jackie Brown. So it had been years since I had auditioned for him, but I was sitting in a restaurant, a little coffee shop on Santa Monica Boulevard, and in walks Quentin. And I saw him from where I was sitting, and I yelled over at him, and he came over, and he sat down with us with another actor. And we blah-blahed for a long time, and this guy was friendly, and he... And as I say, the first time I had run into him, he told me, bing, bang, bing, bang, all the things he had seen me in. And at that point, I was really desperate. My career had really hit the bottom. And I said to myself, maybe some kid who liked me growing up will turn into a movie maker and give me a good part. And in walks Quentin Tarantino. And while we're talking, I say to him, what are you doing? He said, I am adapting Rum Punch, an Elmore Leonard novel, to a movie. He said, why don't you read it? And I did read it. 6 months later, I walked into that same restaurant. I go there every day. I don't now because they tore it down. Now I go to a different restaurant every day. And as I walked in there, I looked over to where I usually sat, and here he is sitting there. He's in my spot. And before I even get to the table, he lifts up this script and extends it toward me and says, read this, see if you like it. I could not have been more astounded. I read it. I called him up. I said, are you talking about, what part are we talking about? I could not believe that he was talking about the part, the best part in the picture, maybe the best male part of that year. And he said, well, I'm talking about Max Cherry. And I said, really? And I said, you know, I've had this experience recently where the guys, the powers that be, you know, the exhibitors or the distributors will not hire me for a big part. And I said, I don't think they're going to let you hire me. And he says, I hire anybody I want. That's when I could not believe my fortune had turned. And it did turn. It gave me a new lease on a career. It mm-hmm. gave me a gift, the size of which cannot be exaggerated. And this guy gave me a new life. And so I know that there were other big actors who campaigned and whose agents were dying for that part, and who he said he denied. He said, no, this part is for Robert Forster. And I cannot tell you what strength that gave me. And yeah. And there you go. I hadn't had a big start in a long time, but I was not at all afraid of banging this one out, because it is like all movies. You don't shoot a movie. You shoot a series of shots. Every single day you lay down shots. You do your best to make the shot have belief and depth. And hopefully you want that shot to be something worth putting into the movie. So you break it down into what it really is, and that is shooting a small, finite number of shots every day. And there you go. I didn't seem to be the least worried. And there you go, Jackie Brown.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite scenes in that film, it's one of the most honest moments on film, and I don't know how you approached it, but you walk out of a movie theater and you can tell it's like you're thinking about Jackie Brown. And it reminded me of being like young and in love. Do you remember how you approached that scene or what you were thinking about to get that peaceful look on your face?
No, boy, you're talking to a guy here. When you say it came out of a movie theater, you don't mean the moment when she comes out of the jail, and as she approaches me, I see her for the first time. We're not talking about that moment, apparently.
Now, this is a much more subtler moment. Your character just walks out of a movie theater, and you're going to meet Jackie at the mall. I don't know. Something about that scene, it fascinates me. I don't know why.
Well, you know, I cannot remember precisely what kind of a thing I might have been thinking of, but it's not that hard. You think of somebody you love. You think of somebody and it's not a foreign feeling. It's one of those identifiable feelings. And if that's how if I remember coming out of a music or being in a music store and looking for the music that I heard while she was in the car.
Yeah.
There are several moments, but I can tell you one thing about the moment when she comes out of jail and I see her for the first time. Mm-hmm. Quentin did something that I've never seen done before in a movie. He played the music while we were shooting the scene. And that music, I can tell you, fills you with feelings and emotions. So he knew about shooting movies. He knew about actors. He knew about creating something that provoked the actor. Mm-hmm. This guy was a great guy to work for. He said things like, well, just make me believe it. And this is the kind of thing that really helps an actor, just to remind him that it's not about hitting the mark, and it's not about da-da-da-da, it's not about a lot of things. It's about belief. And as simple as that is, sometimes it's not that easy, but this guy made it easy.
Yeah, well, that movie is just, it has aged so gracefully, and every time I watch it, I have a new favorite moment.
It's a pretty good movie. I'm grateful and gratified to have been in it.
So a few years back, I'm still obsessed with the show Breaking Bad, and to see you pop up towards the end I was really thrilled. How did Breaking Bad come across your path?
I was sitting in the new restaurant that I sit in, and okay. On a daily basis, you gotta have some place to read the paper and get your breakfast and read scripts and whatnot. And this is the place that I do it. And I was sitting in there, and I got a call from my agent, and they said that Vince Gilligan was about to call me. Really? I said, Vince Gilligan, the guy from Breaking Bad? They said, yes. Minutes later, the phone rang. I walked out to my car, and I had this conversation with him in which he described that for a couple of seasons, they have referred to a guy called the Disappearer, and that they had been saving that part for me, unbeknownst to me. And they said that it shoots in about 2 weeks, and they'd like to have me come to New Mexico and shoot it. And I was clutched because I had a commitment in Rochester, New York, at the Eastman Museum. I'm from Rochester, and I was a trustee of the Eastman Museum at the time, and I still am. And I had committed myself for an event that happened there, a big event. And so I explained to them that I wasn't available on the date that they needed me. However, they didn't seem to be too worried. They fooled around with their schedule. Next thing I know, I did the event in Rochester, jumped on a plane the following morning, very early, arrived in Albuquerque, and went to work. So these guys made it easy. I thought for a second I wasn't going to be able to do that part, but it has been another big moment in my life, being on Breaking Bad. I was only on one episode, mm-hmm. but I did a character that they had teased for a couple of seasons, the Disappearer, and I was again gratified and thrilled to be in it.
So I know you only did one episode, but did you get to hang out with Bryan Cranston and get to know him at all?
I knew Bryan Cranston from before he started doing the show. We play in a poker game. There is a very easy poker game that only actors. It used to be, guys who are now dead, but Sid Caesar and Milton Berle and. Oh God! All those guys that you can remember from the 50s and 60s, the comics and guys who are now passed. But that's how the game started. A guy I knew who lived right across the street from me had this game every Wednesday night. Norby Walters, famous guy out here in Hollywood, and he still has the game. And so. Cranston, Brian was a regular at that game by then. And so we all knew when he went to start this show, Breaking Bad, what kind of a show is it? Well, he said, it's a pretty good show and we're having a good time. And then when the first season was over, he came back to the game regular. And then he said, yeah, we're going to do a second season. And look what happened. It got to be a gigantic hit. And there you go. So he was a good guy to begin with. He's still a good guy, and now he's getting great movie roles.
Well, yeah, I mean, the last season particularly is probably the best television I've ever seen. And I'm hoping that you will show up on Better Call Saul down the line. That would be really cool.
Well, we will see. It could happen, I'm sure, but hasn't happened yet, but you never know.
Last week, the BBC named Mulholland Drive the best movie out of the last 100 years or something. I was wondering, I know you only had a scene or two in that film, but what was that experience like?
I had not done the first Twin Peaks. David Lynch, who I'd never met before, called me one day and said, I want you to do Twin Peaks. And I said, I can't. I had already committed myself to a guy who wrote a wonderful pilot, and so I could not take the job. 25 years ago. And so the guy's pilot, by the way, that I committed myself to, never went to series. So it never went anywhere. But I had honored my commitment. And for whatever reason, I guess David Lynch thought that was honorable. And I never forgot that. And he said, he called me after Jackie Brown, he said, I would like you to be the detective in Mulholland Drive, another television show. And I said, well, this time I'm free and I would be delighted. And so we did the pilot. And then, as you know, ABC did not buy the pilot. And so he bought the footage back from ABC. I think those are the players. And he wrote and shot some new stuff and made it into a movie. And so I had great billing in that picture, even though I only did a couple of little scenes. I did two half days and a half night, maybe two half nights. And my billing in that movie is gigantic because it was the billing that was left over from when the television show was would have been a weekly event.
Right.
Here comes David Lynch with a great job for me. He is a wonderful guy, a real, real artiste, this guy. When you're on his set, people wait for him to say what's going to happen next. Everything is just in suspended animation until David says, okay, we're going to do this. And he's a really good guy and hired me then. I hope he hires me again.
I hope so, too. That's awesome. Did you film anything else that didn't make it into the film?
Are we talking about Mulholland Drive?
Yes.
Not that I remember. You know, I can't remember a lot of things anymore. But I can tell you one thing about that movie. I think very early on in the movie, there is a shot of Los Angeles, a broad night shot of Los Angeles, all those lights out there. I, as a detective, am standing looking over Los Angeles, and I walk back across the road and have a conversation with a policeman. And after we did the shot, David came up to me and he said, do it slower. And so we started the shot. I'm across the street. I'm overlooking Los Angeles. I come back. I have a conversation with the policeman. He comes up and he says, do it slower. Well, a couple more times of doing it slower, and I'm beginning to worry that I'm not believable. I can't quite generate the belief in myself to, and I'm tempted to say, gee, David, I don't believe myself anymore. He says, do it slower. It was only after the movie was, after the television show had not been made, after he had shot his new stuff, after it had gone to France as a movie, been lauded in the French Film Festival by winning the Palme d'Or, only yeah. when it was then nominated for an Academy Award that I realized that I had been in a dream. It was a dream I was in. He never told me. He doesn't tell actors a lot of things, but he's David Lynch. And when he says, I want you to do it slower, you do it slower.
he's such a fascinating guy. I love hearing stories about him. Another director that it really fascinates me is Alexander Payne. And I know you worked on The Descendants with him. Do you have any memories that stick out from that experience?
Well, he is as straight a shooter and as delightful a guy and as creative a guy as you can imagine. It didn't happen right away. I got a call while I was on the freeway, and I think it was around the time that you could no longer use your telephone in the car. You had to have a Bluetooth. And I just bought a car just in time so that I did not have to hold my phone anymore. And the agent called and said, would you do a one scene in a movie? And I said, sure. Let's see what the scene looks like. He said, well, it's for Alexander Payne. Oh, the guy who directed Sideways. Yes. I went home. They shipped me off that that scene. I read it. I read the script. I read the scene. The following day, I went down to Santa Monica and had a meeting with Alexander Payne. And I said, look, I haven't committed the scene to memory. I cannot do the scene for you. But I do understand this about the scene. And I told him the things that I felt I understood. And he said, oh, and by the way, it's not just one scene anymore. It's two scenes. Great, I thought. But in the back of my mind, I said, I had said to myself when I read it the first time, that sock in the nose to the kid is going to be in the trailer. And I said, I'll be thrilled to be in that scene. And so I had this meeting with Alexander Payne, and it might have been 5 months before I got a call from him. And he said, I'd like to invite you to Hawaii to work on The Descendants with us. I've never been called, invited by a director before. He's so considerate and such a gentleman. And I had two scenes. I did them separately. One, they were about a month apart. I went to Hawaii twice. The first time I went, they didn't get to my scene for 10 days. I shot, I drove around Honolulu and Oahu for 10 days before I got to do my scene and went home. And the next time, they didn't get to me for 2 weeks, during which time I had my darling come over, and we went to one of the other islands, and I had a lovely time in Hawaii. So that was a two-scene, beautiful time in Hawaii. And as you know, Alexander Payne is another one of those really top-notch guys.
Oh, man, I'm jealous. Me and my wife had our honeymoon in Hawaii, and I've got to find an excuse to get back there.
One of the most beautiful places I've ever been. I've gone there for work several times.
Awesome. Okay, I've got two more questions if we're okay on time.
You are. We are. Thank you.
Excellent. All right, so I actually had never seen Medium Cool until last month when I was researching for this interview, and that must have been such a crazy experience. Is there one scene or moment that sticks out in your mind among the rest from that movie?
You know, there are, and it was a movie that, as you know, had went under, it transitioned from a movie about a young boy coming from Appalachia who encounters a news photographer in Chicago, and the cinematographer gets involved with their life and with the mother. And it was that kind of a movie. I think it was called Concrete Jungle, maybe.
Okay.
Is that what it, that might be what it was originally called. But if the movie was, if the script was 100%, we shot 200%. We shot all kinds of things that were going on in Chicago at the time. As you know, the events right at the end surrounding the Democratic convention. But we shot a lot of things that were never in the script, but that he wanted to shoot. Haskell Wexler, he could shoot and change his and do something on a dime. He had no trouble throwing a scene at the actors. That's when I learned that they don't always put it on paper for the actor. He said to me once early on, he said, "You're going to do an interview with a society woman this afternoon." And I said, "Have you got something on paper for me?" He said, no, just make it up." That's when I realized, uh-oh, you got to bring a frame of reference to your movie, and you've got to be able to speak. It's not they don't always write it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were at least a couple of those scenes where there was improvisation going on, and I enjoyed the idea of doing the improvs. And here and there, the things that I said, for instance, in an improv at the dinner table, I told the mother that I would bring him to the CYO and show him how to box. Just as a little aside, while we were talking, we were thinking of things to say. And a couple days later, Haskell said, "We're going to go to a fight gym, and we're going to and we're going to do a scene there. And the very ironic remark that I make to the kid as I'm hitting the big bag, I say, see, the object of this is speed, bang, 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 and power, bang. I hit it hard. And I stop it, and then I look at the kid, and I say, no, I say, the object of this is you beat the other guy's brains out, and then you win. And there's irony in it, and there is, but it is something that my father had said to me that I remembered at that moment and put in the movie, and it is in the movie. There is a moment when we are in the apartment of the cab driver who gave back the $10,000. And as we are leaving the apartment, Haskell said to one of the other actors in the apartment, don't let him out. See what happens. And at that point, they wouldn't let me out of the room, and we have this conversation. It gets a little heated, and I say to this guy, the guy and the girl, I say, look, if I got to be scared for your argument to work, you got no argument. And that was simple and an improvisation, and I thought to myself, that is the essence of what I thought at the time and what I believe is true of that moment. And these are the little things that somehow in a movie that's 50 years ago that I still remember. I remember also being embarrassed at the very first action that news photographer does. He shoots the event, and he does not call the ambulance until they're almost gone. He says to the other guy, call 911 or call an ambulance or something. And I always, every time I have seen that movie, am embarrassed for that character. What a heartless, slow reaction to somebody who's hurt and needs help. There's little things that, you know, probably 100 other things if I were to watch the movie or talk long enough.
Yeah. Well, watching that movie last month, it felt so relevant because there's still that much turmoil. And I just thought it was an incredible time capsule from the 60s.
Yeah.
So last question. After working with, you know, some of the best directors that I've ever, you know, worked in film and TV and been on projects like Breaking Bad and Jackie Brown, looking forward, what kind of projects excite you the most?
I can only tell you that I'm very surprised to be still standing. There's an awful lot of actors my age who aren't working and who aren't alive. I'm 75 at this point. I feel like I can go another 15 or 20. But am I going to get that kind of distance? I don't know. All I know is that things come at me that that are interesting and exciting, and I never know what they're going to be. I love getting a laugh. I sincerely love getting a laugh. So if anybody wants to hire me and give me a good joke or two, I will be thrilled to get it.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and I wish you all the best, and I hope there's 15 and 20 more years of acting, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
I'm with you, Brad.
Well, Mr. Forster, thank you again. This was an absolute pleasure and an honor. Have a great one.
You're a gent. I'll talk to you one of these days. Thank you, Brad. Bye.
Many thanks to Robert Forster for hanging out with me this week, and many thanks to you guys for checking out this week's episode. I'll see you next time.
The Brad Dukes Show is a Short Tall Press production in Music City, USA. Copyright 2016, all rights reserved.